All right. Thanks for joining us on the CoachCast podcast. Today, we are joined by Yuri Pagel. So, Yuri, thanks for joining us today. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
No problem. It's our pleasure. I know we've been going back and forward on this one a little bit, just to want to get you on for the second time around. I think you're our second guest for the that's on for kind of a repeat show. So there you go. Why don't you, since if there's anything changed maybe since last time we spoke, why don't you just, or even if someone or some of the people listening don't know kind of who you are, why don't you just give us a quick kind of elevator pitch background on yourself and an update and if anything's changed on your end?
Yeah, I think, Chris, if I'm not mistaken, like the first time I was on the CoachCast podcast, that was right around last year, right? During the start of the first quarantine. I don't know how many we've had by now, but it's been a bunch. So it's been about a year. So yeah, I'm Yuri. I currently work at AFC IX, so the football team here in Amsterdam. Also did that last year. I also work with the 3-on-3 national basketball team, and then I also work with fighting on the side. That's what I've been doing the past couple years. My background primarily being in those three sports. I transitioned into IX. I want to say this is now I'm finishing my second season, and with a 3-on-3 national team, we're going to try to qualify for the Olympics here in the next 2 weeks, which will then be in August. And from that point, I will fully enroll full-time at IX as the head of strength there. So that's kind of what's changed over the past year. You know, a blessing for me. It's a fantastic next phase in my career. Really looking forward to it. And that's pretty much it. It's been a whirlwind of a year, of course, of a season, you know. Working in the pandemic, no fans, also with a 3-on-3 team, having to travel all over the world with all the testing and the bubbles, and some bubbles are very good and solid and other bubbles, well, they're not as good and all that kind of stuff. It's definitely been a whirlwind, but it's, I've learned a ton from this year, probably way more than you would learn from any other randomly or arbitrarily chosen calendar year. So it's been something. It's been a ride.
No, absolutely. And it's been a challenging year for everyone, hasn't it? So why don't we actually start off by getting into that a little bit? I wanted to talk a little bit around in-season training normally, but let's get into how COVID's maybe affected your in-season training and everything else. What's changed? What have you learned that you're going to keep post-COVID?
Well, I think the first thing I looked at, so when quarantine started, I was pretty blessed with the fact that I had already done various forms of online coaching for the past, I want to say, 4 years or something. So I'd already, you know, had a lot of experience working with that, worked with different platforms, using video feedback, looking at athletes' data, like not being able to actually see athletes and still get good results with them. So then when we weren't allowed to work with athletes on site, that was a pretty easy segue for me to immediately transition into basically quote unquote online coaching. So at that point, immediately when things got shut down, I immediately started to set up programs for stuff that they could do without equipment. I think if you look around, the trend in strength and conditioning during that phase was everyone all of a sudden understanding that we can generate force without a barbell, right? We can load athletes and improve athletes without that precious barbell. I think that was a beautiful thing to see. Coaches started to be really creative about exercise selection, developing exercises, you know, playing with lever lengths, playing with all these different kind of manual resistance drills and all those different ways to develop athletes without the stuff that you would normally have to rely on. So it forced coaches and me definitely to think outside of the box. And although that's, you know, it can be difficult at times because you have to go away from something that might have really worked for you, but now didn't work in this setting. So I think that's a really good thing, having to think outside of the box there. So for that first phase when you couldn't see the athletes, you know, that also meant a lot of FaceTime calls with players while they were doing their sessions. It meant a lot of WhatsApp and Instagram DMs to try to make sure that players were actually doing their stuff, and that you could check up on them. But yeah, I definitely learned a lot from that. And then when players returned, yeah, of course had to do a lot of thinking about the logistics of working in a weight room setting. You know, you could have less players. You would probably have more sessions in the day, right? Where you would normally have one or two sessions for one group of athletes of 25, you would now have to split up in five sessions of five players. All of a sudden, you have way less hours in the day to help your athletes. Or maybe you have three squat racks, but they're all within a meter apart, and that doesn't follow government regulations. So you have to, you know, make sure that you have one athlete set up over here, another athlete all the way in the other part of the gym. You know, you're developing, how can I maybe use supersets, trisets, all that kind of stuff to help enhance our training process from a logistics perspective, all that kind of stuff. So if I look back at the whole picture, from quarantine to having to work around logistics issues to having to work around players even getting COVID or having a quarantine because they had close contact, all that kind of stuff, is having to think about solutions, having to think creatively about solutions, because you got all these textbooks and we've got all these things you can read and learn up and all that kind of stuff. But now it really comes down to, you have a very specific problem in front of you. It's unique. Nobody has ever, you know, seen or experienced something quite like this. How are you going to adjust? How are you going to respond to that? And I think that you can really see and start to differentiate between, you know, the maybe the quote unquote elite practitioners, those that are really good at applying theory in practice and understanding what restrictions might be playing a role, and then finding the optimal solution or the best solution given the situation that they're in. I think that's you know, it definitely forced me to think. It was challenging at times, for sure, in a positive sense to me. At least that's how I looked at it. And considering how I've personally grown over the past year, and especially now being extremely excited, of course, about the new opportunities ahead of me, I couldn't be happier about how the last year went, given, of course, the circumstances, because it's been a shit year, you know, any way you look at it.
No, for sure. That is, yeah, I think you've pretty much summed it up. Hopefully for everyone, that's everyone's managed to take a lot from this past year. I know I've grown a lot with kind of my coaching and everything else, and the kind of even just like speaking to people like yourself and learning from everyone else around the world. It's opened up a lot of opportunities. So now you've kind of, well, I say we got through COVID. Some would say it's not really gone, but, you know, we'll pretend it's gone. So we got into your in-season training and things like that. What are you, when it comes to maybe working with basketball and football and things like that, what are you looking at in season? What's your priority? And how does that differ between sports?
Yeah, good question. I think that's, you know, I had my my Strength Coach Network talk or webinar, I want to say, what was it now, 3 months ago, about this topic, or largely about this topic, on Strength Coach Network, about optimizing the training process. Now, that was delivered specifically for basketball audiences, but I also, as kind of a disclaimer, wrote down, like, it doesn't really matter, as long as you're in an in-season phase in team sports, this will largely apply, or the basic principles will apply to any situation in team sports and in-season settings. And I truly mean that, because I think there's a lot of overlap or things that are, I don't want to say identical, but very similar in team sports, regardless of whether you're working in handball, volleyball, basketball, football, rugby, all that kind of stuff. There are just things you're going to see in every team setting. And like you said, I think you really find out about that if you start to communicate with other practitioners that work in different sports, which, like you just mentioned, you know, we're blessed enough to do, maybe even because of the pandemic, right? The last year, getting to know a lot more people in different sports. And I definitely found out that a lot of us had similar problems or saw similar things, and we're also very often similarly looking at the same solutions. Maybe we might call it differently, or maybe we might disagree about minor details, but overall you're going to see very similar solutions to those problems, and one of them being in-season training, because it's such a, I don't want to say it's a hot topic, but it's an oft discussed topic because it's so important. Right. During the off season, I've worked in private settings before a ton. And, you know, to be honest, it's pretty simple. Right. You have all the time. The athletes are coming to you to train, like they want to train. They've already committed their money and their time to come work with you. So they're already engaged and you already have the athlete intent, right? You have the time, the energy, athlete intent, and you generally now just work someone towards their sport. You can say, oh, this guy, let's say in basketball, he wants to jump higher. Okay, he's not going to play basketball for 3 months. That is a lot of energy that would normally go towards 6 days of running, cutting, jumping, and doing it all under fatigue in various different circumstances and situations while they're also having contact with other players and stress from games and travel and all that kind of stuff. That now goes out the door, and you have that same athlete that's used to that stress. You take all that stress away, and now there's this big gap of energy and time available for you to push into the training process. So I don't want to take anything away from private industry work at all. It's very important. Don't get me wrong. I've had great experiences working in that sector, but it is relatively simple compared to when you're working in season in a team environment. And why is that? Is because if you're working in a team during the season, you have many more variables that you have to account for, right? You have to account for what kind of player load they have in practice, their player load in games. You have to take care of what's their travel schedule. How are they mentally feeling and going through the season? Maybe playing, maybe then not playing, having good phases, bad phases, all that kind of stuff. You have to take into consideration what the staff or the other staff members, what their agendas are, what they want to see with the athletes. You know, maybe you have this plan about them increasing their vertical jump. Again, just go for a randomly selected example. You want to increase their vertical jump, but maybe someone else says, no, I really think we need to work on proprioceptive work because he has an extensive history in ankle traumas. And maybe the basketball coach or the assistant coach says he needs to work on setting flare screens, whatever, in basketball, right? Then you have this athlete that's just being pulled from every direction for their energy, right? Because a human being only has so much time and energy that they can spend on anything. It's not an infinite resource. We know this. So that means that there's much less that you can do during the season without compromising something that would be of drastic consequences. Because let's say you do too much. Let's say you don't do too much, then maybe you get that athlete to jump half an inch or an inch higher during the season. Is that going to turn them into that much of a better basketball player? In 99.9% of the cases, I will say no. 5 years ago, I would have said yes, like that's what we're going for, like that's the most important thing. Now, if I say, oh, I have an athlete that jumps an inch higher at the end of the season, you'd be like, well, maybe it's noise. Like maybe he actually jumps higher or maybe it's just noise. I don't know. Is it going to make him a better basketball player? Like how many situations is he going to be in where that's going to be valuable, right? But what is the downside of playing on that, you know, it's a thin line between overstimulating the athlete to the point where they might get hurt or stimulating them enough for where it's growth, right? And one might have a little bit of benefit, but the other could have drastic consequences because the best ability for an athlete, I mean, it's tacky as fuck, but the best ability is availability. It's our job to try to do our best to keep them on court or on the pitch or whatever sport they're playing. So we don't want to take too much risk if it's not necessary. So how I basically view the in-season process is we can consider detraining physical qualities. We can consider retaining physical qualities, or we can consider stimulating physical qualities. So we can look, okay, what physical qualities are important to your sport? So let's say football or basketball, what are physical qualities that are of importance? So let's say we're talking about basketball here. Well, basketball players, of course, need to be able to jump. They need to be able to cut. They need to be able to be strong relative to body weight, solid aerobic base, all that kind of stuff. We know they need this. Then we consider, okay, which of those physical qualities are being targeted through sport practice or game demands? So if you then consider basketball, do they jump during practice? Yeah, like pretty often. Do they cut during practice? Yeah, they do that too. Do you ever get towards the end of the season and that fitness, and that by that I mean conditioning, is a problem for players that have played the entire year if they haven't got injured? No, that won't be the problem. Like, they're being conditioned generally, right? Sports specific conditioning, at least. So these things were not really, like, my question is then, if these are already being targeted through sport practice, if we then also target them as physical, as the quote unquote physical staff, is that going to help enhance or stimulate those qualities? Or might it overload those physical qualities to the point where it might be either detrimental to performance or increase risk of injury? But then there are also certain physical qualities, as I just hinted towards, that we do not stimulate through sport practice or game demands, which, let's say in basketball, for a lot of them would be strength development or training through large ranges of motion, large joint ranges of motion, all that kind of stuff, maybe proprioceptive work. Then you can consider, okay, these qualities we know are of importance, right? We can look at the literature, speak to players, speak to coaching staffs, look at data. We'll understand, okay, this is going to be important, right? The elite athletes tend to be stronger. They tend to be heavier, all that kind of stuff. So then we look at that and we say, okay, is that being targeted through sport practice? No, generally it's not. So then we can supplement that as strength and conditioning coaches or as a physical staff to make sure that we either maintain those qualities if we already have a certain base, right? Or that we stimulate those qualities if the situation warrants it. So let's say we have a player that doesn't have the same amount of game or practice load. We can then supplement training with non-specific or specific means. We can also supplement, you know, with jumping, cutting, et cetera, if they're not getting that from practice and game demands, or non-specific work such as strength training, proprioceptive work, whatever. That's how we can then stimulate those qualities, which then set us up for the off season or the private industry work, whatever we're doing during the off season, to really make those steps in the stuff that we can't really work on during the season. So just to kind of wrap that up and look back at it, it's, you know, what qualities are being targeted through sport practice that are of importance to that game or to the athlete? If they are being targeted, should we still supplement those as a physical staff? If those physical qualities are of importance but aren't being targeted or developed through sport practice or game demands, then we probably do need to stimulate those, or at least focus on retaining those on the side to make sure that we have, you know, we're not starting off the following offseason at a lower level. That's basically in like the gist of how I look at in-season training. And then, of course, you still will have to look at, well, okay, now I know, quote unquote, what to train, right? I'm emphasizing strength more, or I'm emphasizing plyometrics more, or power development, or whatever we're talking about. Then what does that look like in practice, right? Because if you have that set up, and then I'm saying, oh, okay, so we have game day on Friday, so we still need to do strength. Our lightest day is on Friday, so then let's just do strength on Friday after the session. And it's like, well, yeah, you're hitting strength now, and we said that's an important physical quality to train, but you are now interfering with performance on game day on Friday, right? So I don't want to train the day before that. I don't want to train the day before that and then interfere with the athlete's readiness or the team readiness come game day. So it then also becomes, okay, I have these physical qualities set out. I know what I, quote unquote, want to train. Then when am I training these? And what are the dosages, the intensities, the volumes, all that kind of stuff that I am putting towards training those qualities? Also, what tools, so what exercise am I using to stimulate those qualities, to make sure that those qualities either are retained or stimulated, at least making sure they don't get detrained, right? So those are then more practical questions you start asking yourself. And that, of course, also depends then where, that's where I kind of see more of a difference between the sports. So let's say look in football, right? Athletes are generally going to have a lower training age from a weight room perspective. You know, that's going to be just culture-wide in football. That's an assumption we can likely make. While, for instance, they do have more exposure to higher velocities in practice, so maybe, or sprinting velocities, so maybe that's something you supplement less. Well, maybe you supplement strength work a little bit more, of course, only to the extent that it is necessary for that athlete or that team to be able to compete at that level, of course, right? Because otherwise we can just hit the weight room 7 days a week real heavy, and it's not really going to help them in football. Well, maybe in basketball, you really have to adjust for the fact that they play more games during the week. Right. Instead of in football, it might be one or two. In basketball, it could be three or four games. You have to adjust for the types of athletes you're working with in basketball, considering their length, you know, how far they are away from the ground, how that might impact exercise selection, all that kind of stuff. So maybe if you're working in a more contact heavy stuff, heavy sport where they already have very high relative strength to body weight numbers, and maybe you need to focus a little bit more on power development, all that kind of stuff. That's where you really start to distinguish between sports. But the basics to me is still saying, okay, what do we need to develop or maintain? What is being targeted through sport? How do you supplement that? And then in practice, it comes down to, but how do we plan? How do we make sure that we don't interfere with performance? Because as a strength conditioning staff, and I'm telling this to myself 5 years ago, 4 years ago, I'm telling myself, buddy, you're just not that important. Like, I know you think you're like, I know you think you're the shit. Like, I really know you think you're the shit, but you're really not that important. Right. And I don't mean that to take down the strength and conditioning profession or the physical development part, but you are one part of a very big process: technical, tactical, mental, nutrition, medical, physical, all that kind of, all that stuff comes together. You are not more important than any other thing, and the others aren't more important than you. It's all just one part of a process that has to work together in order to make sure that the athlete reaches their peak potential and the team reaches their peak potential. So I think during the season, understand, above all, we can't negotiate about this. We can't talk about it. It's just simple. It's about performance. It's about making sure that the best athletes play all the games and miss as little time as possible, because that gives you the best chance to win. And what you do with all the other players to make sure that they are ready to step in if something does happen, which is a given fact in sport. You know, there is no such thing as, I hate it when people say they can prevent injuries, you know, so it's going to happen, right? There are going to be injuries. There are going to be situations where other players are going to, quote unquote, suck, and you're going to have to step in. So those players are going to have to make sure they're just as physically ready, tactically ready, mentally ready, technically ready to come in. But again, it just comes down having the best players on the court, pitch, what's it called in tennis, doesn't matter. not a shot at tennis. Making sure that they're ready for that, because that gives you the best chance to perform. And all the other things, all the other details, they're secondary to that.
I love that. And I think you covered so many things that I was going to kind of poke you on, actually, and just to see what comes out. But do you mind just quickly, I'm guessing the answer to some questions regarding in-season training would be more around the kind of microdosing approach. You talked about different tools in the toolbox, volumes, intensities, et cetera, et cetera. How do you know, for maybe, do you mind explaining in a little bit more detail for maybe the young coaches that are like, oh, I've heard of microdosing, and what Yuri's talking about makes so much sense, but how do I actually implement that? So like, what do we do if we need to hit speed top-ups or strength top-ups and things like that? Is one rep enough? Do we need to do five sets of five? Like, these kids just coming out of school don't really know. So what would your advice be there?
Number one would be do as little as you possibly can think of, and then do less. That's how it would start off, because again, the upside is far smaller than the downside of making a decision of doing too much, right? So I think that's the first thing you have to look at, is if you're a young coach, you look at the literature, you go in, okay, someone can get strong at a low training age if they do, gosh, I don't know, a 5x5 at 75%, they'll get stronger. Okay. And then maybe the literature also says, well, there's also an 80% chance that they get stronger if they do 5x2 at 65%. Yeah, go for that one, do a little bit less, and then make sure you record your own data with your population, your athletic population. You record that data, you look back, did they get stronger? Fantastic. That's all you need to know. Then from there, you just progress. So, you know, if I can tell any young coach at any point, if you're starting off, gather your own data. It'll be maybe worthless down the road, right? Because you're not going to be good at understanding how to find data in a practical setting and still understand that it's worthwhile, that it actually tells you something, because, you know, you're not going to be in one structured environment. It's going to be chaotic. There's going to be a lot of noise in the data, but you still just always want to have quote unquote, a hypothesis for yourself, something that you're saying, something that you're seeing, okay, I think my athletes are going to get stronger if I do this. You actually pull through, you do that, and then you see, did they get stronger? Yes or no? Were there non-responders? Were there different kinds of responders? All that kind of stuff. And that's basically how you start to understand what works and what doesn't work. Because I could, you know, Chris, I could sit here and be like, yeah, I mean, sheesh, make sure you just do 3x3 on a power clean every day and 6 days a week for microdosage. And in total, that's a shit ton of reps and you're going to get more explosive and you're probably not even going to be wrong. But it's definitely going to depend on your context that you're going to find yourself in. Now with the microdosing thing to me, so for those who don't know, I personally use microdosing as a way to spread out volume over a week. I look at it as putting one big spoon of peanut butter on one part of the sandwich, eating that, and then eating dry ass sandwich for the, like the remainder of the sandwich itself, or spreading out the peanut butter, right? And then maybe you don't have that one beautiful little bite of peanut butter that something also resembles a piece of sandwich that's underneath, and then the rest is dry as fuck. Like, I want to make sure that it's spread out evenly. And there's a ton of different reasons why I would do that. There's also reasons why you might not do it, and I'll get to that in a little bit. But first, why I would. Now, if we understand in-season training, right, what I just say, okay, the biggest thing is performance. We do not want to negatively influence performance on game day, because if we do, that hinders chance at W's. If we don't win, people get fired, including you, possibly. Whether it's your fault or not, you know, that's just part of the game. So we want to make sure we don't interfere with that. Now, if you work in practice, you understand that there will be certain training stimuli that are going to induce a lot of fatigue in the athletes, team-wide or maybe on an individual level. If I have two training sessions throughout the week, let's say I play on Friday and I train on Monday and I train on Wednesday, by definition, on Wednesday, I'm not really going to be able to load very heavy because we're 48 hours away, right? If I do a really heavy strength session, then it'll likely negatively influence performance on game day. Of course, it depends on the dosages, all that kind of stuff, but let's just assume that we're just going for a traditional heavy strength training. Then, of course, it is likely going to influence that. It might even influence the following day's sport practice, which then subsequently second-order effect has a negative result on performance on game day. So if I have those two sessions, and let's say the day before the second session is on Tuesday, they have their heaviest sport session, which was negatively influenced by the training session on Monday. Sport coach comes in, says, hey, my guy, like, I know you love squatting. You know what I like more? My players hitting the back of the net. They didn't do that because they were all complaining about how sore their legs were. Don't do it again. All of a sudden, you're finding yourself in a situation where it's like, oh, that's not the relationship people say I should have with my sport coach. And then he goes really heavy that day because he's disappointed in the fact that the players aren't performing. He's pissed off. He's saying, oh, rubbish, your legs are all tired. I don't care. He makes them run extra gassers because he's old school and that's what he loves to do. Then the next day on Wednesday, they come in and guess what kind of athletes you're going to find? Not very happy athletes, not the ones that are going to have high intent for training. You know, whatever situation, if you have 2 days or 1 day a week where you're doing something with them and your athletes don't have high readiness on that day, or there is an important thing the next day or the day after, that really influences the training stimuli that you can offer to those athletes. Because you're going to be restricted. Because you only have that one moment and you have to put all your eggs into that one basket, that one little bite of sandwich with a whole lot of peanut butter, that's all you're going for. But if I spread out the volume and the intensity throughout the week, I can now better adjust basically that the physical qualities that I target on each session, quote unquote, match what they want to do on the pitch, or at least match the intensity of that day. So let's say maybe you're going for a high-low model, that what we're doing in the weight room is highly neurologically demanding and very low on a day when it's low on pitch or low on court, all that kind of stuff. Or maybe if they have the day off the following day, that we then had a very, very heavy weight room session the day before, all that kind of stuff. but we just make sure that we are accommodating our physical work to the rest of the week. We're understanding that stress is holistic, and we're just playing around the same way that the sport practice week goes, building up towards a game, which, you know, most sport coaches are going to work that way, regardless of whether they're old school, new school, however they work, they do have some kind of way of working towards game day. Then you accommodate, you do basically the same thing, you work around it. And what I have seen in practice personally is it gets a lot more athlete intent. One, you see them every day. You know, we gather all this data about readiness and wellness scores and this and that. I see a lot of athletes before sport practice in the weight room because we microdose in the morning before practice, before they go out for their warmups. I see them. I see how they come in. Maybe they're very lazy, laid back, or maybe they're very loud and obnoxious and running all over the place and who knows what. So you then already have a much better grasp of how they're doing that day, and you can already interfere at that moment and contact sport coach or whatever and say like, hey, I'm seeing this and this and this, you know, maybe this has implications towards poor practice, all that kind of stuff. So that's one thing. I see the athletes every day and I work with them every day. Then number two, they're in there for a shorter period of time. Now, most sports aren't going to be American football or rugby or other contact sports where athletes really enjoy and see the value in strength work. If you work in other sports, you will have athletes that love the weight room, but the majority just do it because they feel like they need to. And some of them, or maybe even a lot of them, do it because they have to and they're being forced to. So if I can get them in, do the work that is necessary for that day and get out, fantastic. Like, that makes me happy, makes the athletes also happy, because I've literally worked with a group and they come in and they literally determine whether the strength session is going to be difficult by the amount of exercises that is written on the board. They don't even look at intensity prescriptions, volume, all that kind of stuff. They literally just look, oh, coach, you got 8 exercises. Oh, I don't want to do this. But if you write down 3, they come up and they're like, you got 3 lifts? That's it? And I'm out? I'm like, yeah, it's only 3 reps too. Just go heavy on that. And they're like, cool. You know, because that's like, that's fine. They're like, oh yeah, yeah, I can do that for 3 exercises. And you don't have to really compromise as much, because if I have 8 exercises and I want high intent on all of them, you're not really going to have that discussion or argument with them. Like, that's not going to work. But if I have 1 exercise that's really the bang for that day, the big one, let's say it's a box squat, right, on a strength day, like, that's important. I'm doing 3x3 on a box squat. And then I have a proprioceptive exercise and a power exercise. But I really want them to focus on the box squat. I'm like, hey, we got 3 exercises, but that one, that box squat, hey, come on, buddy. Like, I mean, you're only here for 20 minutes. Like, that's what you can give me, right? And it's an easy conversation to have with the athletes. They tend to enjoy it more. It just becomes part of their process because they're not if athletes have like the 2 sessions, because they're so long and grueling sometimes, they start to hate those sessions. But if they're short and more enjoyable, they don't mind it as much coming back every day. It just becomes part of the process. They're just like, oh, before practice, we go in there 20 or 30 minutes and we go out, like, every single time. So from an athlete buy-in perspective, it's fantastic. From a making sure we're not interfering with sport practice or performance, I also consider it fantastic. If I have a low training age group, I have these guys 6 days a week or 5 days a week where I can hammer in movement patterns constantly. That's perfect. I see them more. Overall, I have more time with them. I can spend more time with them. I see how they're behaving. I see how they're responding throughout the week, all that kind of stuff. So it's just a lot of pluses to me. Basically, if you look at in-season training, it is not about whether you're going to see chaos. It's about how you're going to respond to chaos. And what basically microdosing does to me is it gives me the most flexible tool to program, because I'm already seeing them every day. Now, if they had a very heavy session the day before, I can already adjust for the following day because I'm going to understand how they come in. I can change, and then maybe I will switch something to another day, all that kind of stuff. It's just very easy for me to play around with different variables to the point where we are, again, I'm working around the chaos. I'm learning how to play with the chaos instead of it just coming. I'm like, all my players, oh, they're all fatigued. And I had 3x8, or I had my 3x3 box squad, and I had this set up and that set up and all that kind of stuff, and I can't do it. So now I'm just in a position to be flexible to whatever the environment gives me. Now, one thing I must say, though, kind of like a disclaimer, this will only work if you have buy-in from your head coach or your sport coach staff, because if they, you know, they might say, like, in the weight room every day, it's not that important. So you really got to make them understand, like, yeah, it's not like we're making them do much more. We're just spreading out volume, right? We're just making sure that the athletes still get the stimuli that they need. But what we're doing is we're adjusting over, you know, more sessions, basically. So basically use the peanut butter analogy. That's one thing. You need buy-in from your staff, because if you don't have buy-in from sports staff, good luck. Like, you're fighting an uphill battle. That's one thing. And then two, well, you just got to be there full time. Like, if you're not full time with the squad, like, you're not going to be able to come in every day and do your work before practice, all that kind of stuff. It's not going to happen. So a couple of things you would need: one, sports staff support. And then two, actually be there and get paid for it. That's nice. But then if you do have that, just because of how much change and chaos you are going to encounter during the season, I find it a very, very valuable tool. And I'd use it probably in almost any situation that I find myself in, if the situation allows me to.
Mm-hmm. I like that. I think that's great. There's two big things I took from that. Is one, microdosing is like the Swiss Army knife of training. And then two, I'm never going to look at peanut butter in the same way again.
Well, you got, I mean, I've really had like a thing for peanut butter over the last few weeks. I've just had cravings for peanut butter. So then I start to think about analogies for peanut butter for pretty much anything else. It's kind of odd, but hey, bear with me here.
I mean, it works though, right? Like, hey, I get it. I think it works, and it's that's a great analogy. Getting away from peanut butter, okay. I'd like to get into a little bit to do with plyometrics, your approach for kind of training them. I know you've kind of spoke about that before, because we had Matt McKinney's Watson on recently. I call him like the young Verkashansky. So the guy's legit when it comes to plyos. I just want to know kind of, what do you think about plyometrics? How do you kind of introduce them in maybe a team sport environment, especially when it comes to maybe you work with basketball, for example? A lot of people be like, what they do is plyometrics is jumping. Like, how do you take that approach with an athlete that already jumps? Do you give them more of what they've already got? Do you give them something a little bit less intense, more intense, make them more robust? Like, what's your approach with that?
Well, one, I really, really, really effing hate the fact that I'm following up on Matt on anything regarding plyometrics. That's just not cool. Like, I don't appreciate this whatsoever. Also, I know he doesn't appreciate the young Verkashansky nickname, but he does.
Yep.
Matt, come on, just take it. Like, it's fitting. It's yours. Take it. Matt is a great guy. I've asked him way too many questions. Like, he should literally send me a very large invoice. I hope he doesn't. Matt, please don't. But he's fantastic, and he's definitely one of the foremost experts on plyometrics that we have today. I really think so. And anything I'll say is just going to be much less valuable than what he has to say on plyometrics. So if you haven't listened to that, I'm plugging this. I'm plugging this hard. Like, I'm not getting paid for this, people. But if you haven't,
head back to episode 23. Go hit that one up.
23, hit it up. If you want to understand anything about plyometrics, make sure you listen to Matt, because plyometrics is just such a misunderstood, and me and him actually had a pretty long chat about this a couple weeks ago. It's such a misunderstood way of training, you know, training methodology. I don't want to call it a methodology, but it's just so misunderstood. One person is going to say that jump roping is going to be plyometrics. The other say are going to say that a static box jump will be a plyometric. And the other will say, no, only if it's repeated hurdles over 70 centimeters and depth jumps from 120 is going to be a plyo. So, you know, I think his work in making sure that we have unified understanding of what plyometrics are is super valuable for the field. And I really, really support his quest in that. And I think that's fantastic. So people just go listen to that. Hope that plug was okay. But for me personally, like I try to understand, and that's why I'll go to an expert like Matt. And of course he's far more well-rounded than just plyos, but I'll go to an expert on something, for instance, that, or maybe John Evans on jump technique. I've been a real pest to him too about asking questions for weightlifting, ask weightlifters, all that kind of stuff, sprinters. For instance, I work with a former Olympian in sprinting, and I'll just keep on asking questions about all these different things, because in reality, if you work in team sports, basically what you just said about microdosing being a Swiss Army knife, that's how you have to be as a strength coach or a physical staff member in a team sport setting. You have to understand everything to the point where you can utilize any tool. So that tool might be pliers, that tool might be non-impact ballistics, it might be strength work or sprinting or energy systems development. It is all these different things that you have to have a basic understanding of if you want to give the athletes the best chance of, again, achieving their optimal potential, basically, right? That's, you're going to need to be able to tap into different tools. And plyometrics is a massive tool in doing so. And like I said, because it's so misunderstood, you get these things of people saying like, oh, don't do plyometrics until someone has established this kind of strength level or that other strength level that is totally unrelated to plyometrics. And they will say that it is a quote unquote prerequisite in order to start a plyometric program. So if I look at my own work, I tend to say, okay, it is totally different from, for instance, strength training. Of course, there's force applied into the ground on both, but it is just massively different. But there are also both very valuable tools for increasing athlete robustness over time, as well as increasing performance. So I just see them as two different things that we both need to develop in athletic populations, regardless of who you're working with. It could be a fighter, could be a football player, volleyball player, basketball player, whatever. They're going to need to develop those pillars or qualities to eventually be able to have their optimized potential down the road. So we have to develop both. I don't think we have to develop one before we develop the other. We might prioritize one a little bit more over the other because one could lay a quote unquote foundation for the other to really, really, unleash its effectiveness as far as the stimulus is concerned. Maybe that's the case, sure. But I think we have to develop all of them concurrently. So if I have a young athlete, it's not like I'm saying, oh, we're only going to do strength work and we're going to wait with plyos until someone has a 1.5 or 2 times body weight squat, because it's an arbitrarily selected lift that has very little transfer to plyometrics if you understand the difference between the different modalities here. So then we say, okay, one isn't going to be a prerequisite for the other. We just develop both concurrently. We start extensive, so submaximally with both. We start submaximally with strength training as well as with plyometric training. And then extensive just being a synonym for submaximal intensities, basically. So for instance, that could be how we're going from a bodyweight squat to a goblet squat to a zombie front squat to a cross face front squat to a front squat to a back, or maybe an overhead squat to a back squat, all that kind of stuff. And we're increasing intensity over time, right? Because we're changing these exercises that go from not allowing high external load, thus we are staying submaximally. And every time we put the weights in a more favorable position, thus allowing more external load over time as the athlete progresses and ages and goes through the maturity process and that kind of stuff. In plyometrics, we can do the same thing, right? We can do the same thing. We can say someone starts with these extensive forms or submaximal plyometrics, long coupling, short coupling variations, skips and bounds, real extensive. Maybe there's only 10 or 20 centimeters of displacement horizontally or vertically, all that kind of stuff. We can develop these drills and then increase intensity over time. For instance, if we're, let's say, you're a big fan of drop jumping. Okay. I wouldn't necessarily use that with many athletes, especially at low training edge, but let's say you do, you can increase box height over time. And by that, you are already intensifying the exercise. Also, if I get better at plyometric drills, generally, they're going to be, quote unquote, self-intensifying. Because if I jump higher and higher and higher as I adapt and my ability to jump increases, then my outputs will grow. Either my ground contact times are going to go lower, or my jump heights are, or my body's displacement is going to be greater. So I already have automatically more intensity. It's self-intensifying. So over time, just like the squat, we develop our strength there. We also do so in plyometrics at the same time. And if we do that correctly, not saying there's one way of doing this, but if we do that semi-correctly, then they're probably growing at the same pace. Maybe for one, it'll be a little bit, you know, faster than the other because they're very good at adapting to strength and not as much to plyometrics or the other way around. But we're not waiting for one to reach this, again, I consider it arbitrarily selected point before introducing the other. I want to say we're doing it both at the same time. Now, if I, for instance, go back to your example about basketball, if you're working with the young athletes, like I'm exposing them to this stuff. Because like you said, it could have a lot of impact on robustness in the future. Because I'm making them more resilient to these forces, these various forces at high speeds, low speeds, large ranges of motion, short range of motion, all that kind of stuff. So if we're looking at strength work and plyometrics, all that kind of stuff. It is also very good because we're taking them away from their sport, right? And we're giving them different movement patterns and different stimuli instead of always doing more of the same, which is, I consider, a problem in athletic development at the moment, that they always just do one thing and basically just pushing the athletes there instead of having a wide base of support in order from there to build a very high pyramid, which again, optimized athletic potential. So I think at a young age, I'm definitely, even in basketball, just throwing in a lot of plyometric work, just making sure you understand what their impacts already are on the court. You know, once we get to later training ages, it then depends on what their training history is, right? If they're not, if they haven't been exposed to plyometric drills, and you see them for the first time during the preseason, you haven't had them during the offseason. So you see these athletes during the preseason have no previous exposure and they immediately get into high basketball loads. And if you've ever worked with basketball, you understand there's no such thing as a slow ramp on during preseasons. They start off hard and that's, you know, that's where all the patellar tendinopathy and Achilles tendinopathy stuff starts to flare up. If I then also consider, oh, hey, let me just add more of this. Let me add more plyometric drills. I'm probably just going to be doing more of the same. And again, maybe that then comes down to, am I not overloading them too much? Am I not increasing the risk of injury instead of decreasing the risk of injury? My head has gone a myriad of ways of thinking, okay, but then should I supplement with extensive work only, right, to lay a foundation? Or should I supplement with very small dosages of very high intensity plyometrics because that's what they're not being exposed to in sport, right? Because everything is almost always going to be submaximal. Like we don't have a lot of breakaway dunks that are max effort where they're not fatigued. All the changes of direction are going to be submaximal or under fatigue in a chaotic setting, right? So maybe we actually need to supplement with very minimal dosages of very high stimulus or intensity stressors, plyometric stressors. You know, I've thought about all of them. I've played with all of them. And I'd love to say I have an answer for you. And I don't. I'd be lying if I said I do. But what I have seen is that it's just dependent on the athlete. And with the 3-on-3 national team, I'm lucky with the fact that our Olympic selection is, we're working with 8 athletes up close. So it's a very small group. So I can individually adjust much easier and see, okay, this athlete doesn't respond well to high Achilles loading. And this athlete doesn't respond well to high patellar tendon loading, all that kind of stuff. And then you just adjust on the fly. But if you have a larger group, again, I've gone from thinking, okay, just do extensive to just do highly intensive. And likely as with anything, the answer lies somewhere in the middle. I don't know exactly where it is. But that's basically how I look at it. Like, okay, you know, we already have these high stressors or we have these like moderate stressors, then how are we going to supplement this? Again, I focus on what's being done during sport practice and how can we supplement. Just the how, that to me is still a question. It'll always be a question to me. But yeah, that's basically, I don't know if I answered your question because I went on another rampage of a rant again, but hope it did.
No, I think so. And I think it's another one of those things that unfortunately where it depends and there's more than kind of one answer. It's definitely not black and white. And the way I kind of think of it is like with a lot of things, especially in that team sport environment, it's, well, let's try and raise the roof and then dig out the basement, you know, make those foundations as strong as possible, as deep as possible, because sport is played somewhere on that kind of second floor, somewhere like that. So we've got to just keep building up and giving us those outputs when we need them. And then hopefully the basement's deep enough that where we can just recover, use that aerobic system more and more. So we can actually show the outputs and the quality that we've got. That's the stuff that we all know speed kills. So we've got to be able to expose them to that and allow them to use those skills that they did spend so long developing when they're given the right opportunity.
Absolutely. And I think, if you look at it that way, like you're saying, speed kills, I think there's a common misconception about basketball players that they all jump really high. Like, no, they don't. Like, they just have massively, massively long limbs and they're very tall, but a lot of them don't jump that high. Like, if you put them on force plates, they're not very impressive, at least a lot of them. And then you're just thinking, okay, how can I improve this? But again, just making sure the biggest ability is availability, so I'm not interfering with that. But like you said, you know, I find it tough to have to give the it depends answer. And as much as I hate dogmatic people that just say like, oh, this works and that doesn't work and all that kind of stuff, I kind of also hate the people that say it depends, but then don't give you some kind of context, right? It's like, I can always just, if you ask me a question, I'm like, well, it depends. And then just shrug it off and walk away. It's like, yeah, it depends, but I can still say like, okay, my hunch is that it'll likely work here or that it might not work, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, you start to look at different contexts and where something might or might not work, but you know, of course you try to give a little bit more than the just it depends answer, because that's probably just as bad as the dogmatic douchebag.
This is true. All right, Yuri, well, I'm wary of the time over there, and I know you need to get your beauty sleep because you'll be up early in the morning, and God, we know you need it.
I don't know if it's a shot or a compliment, either or. I'm happy. You know, if you ain't got haters, you ain't popping.
Exactly. You got to take it and run with it, you know? Exactly. Yeah, I'm just jealous. I can't look like, is it Thor? Is that what we're going for?
I've literally the FIBA 3-on-3 page, they call me Coach Caveman. I thought that was pretty ridiculous.
I just gotta take what you can get these days, you know.
Exactly. Again, I don't get too many compliments anymore, so it is what it is. I gotta take any of them.
Well, fair enough. I'll give you a compliment. Thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. That was awesome. I took a good few pages of notes here, so I really really appreciate it. Just before we wrap it up, if anyone wants to kind of reach out to you, follow you on social media, because I know you're very active on there, like where can they find you?
Yeah, so I'm mostly on social media. That'll be Instagram on the at Yuri Pagel. That's YOERIPEGEL. Other than that, yeah, I'm not really, I don't really do much. I try to write for Jay DeMeo's website, CVASPs. I've just been terrible with it. I'm sorry, Jay. Like, I'm really sorry. It's just been hard trying to find the time, but it's definitely something that I want to do more next year. But if, you know, I try to do something on Instagram every day, and I just throw things that are in my head, like I just said about the whole thing, like about context and how different things might work. If I have something in my head, I tend to just throw it out there and see what happens. If you want to get a little bit more of an idea of what goes on in my head, and then social media is probably going to be the easiest way to go.
There's a lot of things that go on in that head as well. So go head over to that Instagram channel and check it out.
A lot of stories and a lot of posts.
I think on that note, I think we'll leave it there. Thanks again, buddy.
Yeah, thanks, Ash. Thanks, Chris. It was a pleasure being on here. Thank you.